Thanks for the thank you to the organizers for the chance to give this talk. I'm going to talk about a project that we've been working on with David Reuter for at least a couple years now, and the story kind of has evolved over the years, but it's sort of so that's why we still haven't written it up yet. But I think we're at the point that if I could find a few weeks to just sit and write, we'd have the paper done, like all the math's been done. So that's what I'm going to tell you about. And I didn't, anyway, so there I'm going to have, well, anyway, that's the story. So, right, so I want to talk about kind of a, about sort of a way of extracting homotopy groups from, at least from TQFTs. So let me start by telling you very briefly the type of thing I would want to be able to extract. This is sort of the right way to do homotopy theory. So if you have a space, if you have just an actual space, any actual space has some data, some algebraic data that you can extract from it. There's lots of algebraic data you can extract from a space, but some of the data you can extract is, first of all, you can extract its fundamental groupoid. This is the fundamental group, but it, in families over where the base point is. Fundamental groupoid. Another thing you can extract from a space is you can extract, well, at any point in the space, there's a fundamental group at that base point. So not fundamental, the higher homotopy groups at that base point. And as the point varies over the space, those homotopy groups vary sort of as functors from the fundamental groupoid to the category of abelian groups. And this is really the best way to think about what higher homotopy groups are, is that they're local systems of groups on the fundamental groupoid. But if you like working with base points, you know, if your space is connected, you could have just picked a base point. Then you would just have this is just a BG for some group. And then I'm just saying that these are representations, that these abelian groups, I'm just telling you, when I tell it to you as a representation of the groupoid, I'm just telling you that this remembers the action of pi 1 on pi k, which is the sort of maybe the zeroth thing you write down about a space is the sequence of homotopy groups, and the first thing you write down about a space is the action of pi 1 on the higher homotopy groups. And then if you go further, there's more algebraic information. There's all sorts of higher brackets that I'm not going to try to talk about. I'm going to be satisfied if I can get this much information. So that's my goal. That's my goal of, like, when I say I've understood the homotopy groups, this is what I'm after. So I'm going to already start, I'm going to sort of give the game away already of sort of how I'd like to do this. So another thing I can do with a space, so as a topologist, this is what I would do. As a quantum field theorist, something I would do is I might try to write down a sigma model for my space. And now whether I can write down a quantum sigma model or not will depend very much on whether the path integral for the sigma model converges. But certainly if my space has, say, only finitely many non-trivial homotopy groups and all of them are finite, then there's a well-understood sort of finite path integral, a topological sigma model that by now is kind of pretty well understood by people by probably many people here. So at least in that case, this is something I can certainly do. And maybe I could talk about topological sigma models more generally. Maybe they won't really have a partition function. Maybe they'll only have Hilbert spaces, but no partition functions or something like that. Well, I don't just want to write down the sigma model. Another thing a space has is that the sigma model is better than just a quantum field theory. Sigma models come with a distinguished boundary condition. They come with a boundary condition called the Neumann boundary condition. So a sigma model, the dynamical fields in a sigma model are just maps to the target space. And the Neumann boundary is where you don't put any conditions on the dynamical fields at the boundary. They're still allowed to be anything they want. Yes?
Why Neumann and not Dirichlet?
Great question. So Dirichlet just requires more choices. So there's another boundary condition that any sigma model has, but it's not just one boundary condition. Another boundary condition any sigma model has is called Dirichlet, and it depends on choosing a point. If you've chosen a base point in your space, then there's a boundary condition called Dirichlet, where the rule is that the field in the bulk is allowed to vary, but when it hits the boundary, it has to take value that point. So this is not a single boundary condition. This is a family of boundary conditions. Neumann is the one that's sort of the universal thing that you have. But the reason why you might want to remember these boundary conditions is because they are what undoes gauge duality between different theories. Like, even this is, like, if you think about sort of why, like, you might have two different Lagrangian theories. You might have, say, two different Maxwell theories or something like that, two different gauge theories, whatever it is. And a typical thing that physicists get extremely excited about, or at least used to get extremely excited about, is when you have two different Lagrangian field descriptions of a field theory, and then you prove that these two field theories are isomorphic. And then you pat yourself on the head and you say, like, I've discovered a duality. And one of the things you discovered was you discovered that there are these sort of isomorphisms of the quantum sigma model that didn't come from isomorphisms of the Lagrangian description. And you might think that that's a feature, or you might think that that's a bug. And if you think it's a bug, if you really wanted to get that space back out of your sigma model, the classical space, the target space, if you want a procedure that can recover target space from a sigma model, the type of thing that can break this duality is to remember the Neumann boundary. You can say this more sharply, but certainly in examples, if you have a favorite duality between different sigma models, that duality will exchange Neumann and Dirichlet, or will do something more complicated with the different boundary conditions. And I encourage you, if you haven't really thought it through, I encourage you to just, in an example, see what happens to boundary conditions under dualities. So I want to say another fact, and then I'll come back to Justin's point. I claim that the sigma model by itself cannot know the target space. We just said that the bulk of a sigma model can have dualities in equivalent spaces with different homotopy groups can give isomorphic sigma models. That's just a thing that happens in examples. But I claim to you that if I remember the Neumann boundary condition, then from the sigma model, I have a wonderful way to extract the homotopy groups. And I'll tell it to you what it is. I have to remember a little bit more. I'll also, as Justin suggested, I'll remember some Dirichlet boundary conditions. So here's what I do. I can look at, I'm in, say, n plus 1 dimensions. So let me look at a solid torus, which has a k-dimensional sphere and an n minus k-dimensional disk put together. This is just a solid torus. And I'll put my field theory in the bulk. This is my sigma model. And I'll put my Neumann boundary condition almost everywhere on the boundary. And then I'll put my Dirichlet boundary condition at one point, or at least a little disk at one point. And then I'll calculate this is total dimension n of bulk dimension. And so this is a thing that should assign a Hilbert space under my field theory. And I can just work out what that Hilbert space is. So what is the Hilbert space of anything? Well, you look at all the maps from here, like all the fields that satisfy those boundary conditions. And then you just take the vector space spanned by those, the vector space of functions on the space of fields. That is what the Hilbert space has to be, or L2 functions or something like that. So let's just do it. I want fields from this solid torus into my target space. There's no condition on the field when it hits the boundary, except there's a condition at one point. Okay, well, everything's sort of, I'm just doing topology. So a field on a solid torus might as well contract out to a field just on the core of this torus. This sort of extra disk dimension isn't doing anything for me. That contracts away. So this is just a map from the K-sphere into my target space. And then I'm putting one condition at one point on the K-sphere. So I'm exactly getting the K-dimensional, the K-based loop space of my target space at that base point. So the Hilbert space I construct is exactly the space of functions on the K-th homotopy group at that base point. And you can do, if you want to do it on your own, you can check that, in fact, this Hilbert space is not just as a vector space, but you can get the whole, there's a group algebra, you can get the full Hopf algebra of this group algebra. And the Hopf algebra is, and I'll do it again on like two slides, so you don't have to think about it now. I'll show you the sort of what these are, but you really, sort of various things like pairs of pants and co-pants on this product manifold recovers the whole group algebra. Okay, so this is something about sigma models, yes?
So physically, can I think of this point with Dirichlet boundary condition as the existence of some defect, like a vortex or something, whose core lives along that? The target space is S1, pi 1 of S1 is Z, and there's some defects characterized by Z.
So I wouldn't say that defect was the existence of that Dirichlet boundary condition. I mean, somehow the Dirichlet boundary condition isn't even really a thing. Like, I really wanted a representation of the fundamental groupoid anyway, so this boundary condition is sort of no choice. It'll be allowed to vary. If you want to think of it in defects, I think that's like the thing that is seeing that S1 is the fact that I'm walking around here. So the defect is the fact that this has a hole in it.
I see.
Okay, so now let me tell you the goal of our project. Yes?
So is it possible to have boundary conditions on either Dirichlet or Neumann?
Absolutely. There's lots and lots of other boundary conditions on a sigma model. But when I told it to you as a sigma model, I told you these two favorite boundary conditions. Like sigma models have the property. There's other things that are not sigma models. There's like lots of types of field theories. And any description of a field theory will, that because I've given a description of it, I will also, in the process of giving you sort of a Lagrangian description, I probably also give you some boundary conditions that are easy to write down, that are preferred by the Lagrangian description of the theory. There might be many other Lagrangian descriptions that are just not preferred by your, there might be many boundary conditions that are not preferred by your Lagrangian description. In the case of sigma models, the two preferred boundary conditions are this Neumann one and this family of Dirichlet ones. But no, there's lots and lots of mixed conditions. The typical thing, a typical thing you could do is you could pick any any subspace of your space. And then there's a mixed Neumann-Dirichlet condition that says that, that at the boundary, the field doesn't have to go all the, doesn't have to be valued at that point, but it has to be in that subspace. So you have this whole family of boundary conditions interpolating from these single points to the whole space. And then there's lots more of things. Like, that's not the full list of boundary conditions. There's sort of boundary conditions that are fundamentally quantum, that don't come from subspaces. So this is just sort of classical topology. I'm just doing classical homotopy theory, and I decided to use quantum field theory language. But there's nothing new here. This is like 20th century homotopy theory. No, I don't know, almost 19th century, yes.
So you mentioned L2 functions that you're putting.
Yeah, I sort of really want a Hilbert space, so I don't really want C, I want L2, but these are all finite. I'm going to now sort of imagine that my target spaces are sufficiently finite to have good TFTs.
But then again, you still have to norm complete the group algebra.
Well, if I'm sufficiently finite to have a good TFT, then I do not have to do such a thing. No, you would have to work harder than I'm working if you wanted to handle infinite dimensional spaces.
Right. Okay.
But I want to sort of do some pure category theory, some pure topology, and I'm not going to do that analysis. But it's something that should be done. So anyway, so just to sort of say what I want to do, now this was something, these were things I could extract, and all I used about my sigma model was that it was a quantum field theory, and it had a thing called Neumann boundary, and it also had this other thing called Dirichlet boundary that I'm going to get to in a moment. And so the goal that I have is I want to think of, now I want to do the following. I want to say, let me suppose I have any TFT at all with a boundary condition. What I'd like to do is I'd like to imagine, I'd like to pretend that my TFT was some sort of quantum sigma model with some sort of quantum target space. And I'd like to just pretend that my chosen boundary condition is called Neumann, even if it didn't come in that way from your description. I will just try to treat it as if it's Neumann. And that's going to be the goal of my talk. Okay. And then what I will tell you how to do is, given any TFT with a boundary condition, I will think of it as if it's a sigma model with Neumann, and I'll just run the same formulas and extract homotopy groups from it. So that's the outline of the talk. Okay.
Sorry,
yes.
When you say you're going to think about it as if it's Neumann, can you explain again what that means?
It's in some sense, it's a contentless thing. Like, it's like, all I'm going to do is I'm going to input a field theory and a boundary condition, and I'm going to do constructions that only take that input. But I'll be motivated as by sort of seeing what the construction, like if I have something I want to do, I see what I would get if it were a sigma model with Neumann. I kind of train my construction on that example, and then I'll just apply the construction to some other example. That's what I mean. Yes.
Is there any condition on the boundary condition? Any boundary condition can be said Neumann?
I will allow any boundary condition, and I will. So probably, I'm going to do a thing that can input any boundary condition. I mean, if your boundary condition, if you happen to choose the zero boundary condition, then my thing will output the zero as the answer, which isn't a perfectly good answer. It's not a very interesting answer. So if you want this to be an interesting construction, you should input an interesting boundary condition. But no, there's no condition for the boundary condition. OK, I think everything I'm going to say, I'm going to assume that I'm like fully compact TFT. I have lots of dualizability. But that's all I'm going to assume. Okay.
Yes? Do you see any good two different combinations that employs some
some defect in the interface.
That's right. So there's this sort of the edge of this boundary. And that choice matters. In the only example that I've told you about, I did implicitly make that choice. I chose it to be the canonical thing, which is that well, in the bulk, the fields were arbitrary. In the green boundary, the field was arbitrary. In the red boundary, the fields had to be valued at the base point. And on the boundary between boundaries, I'll just take the sort of Dirichlet boundary between boundaries that sets the base point. That's a thing I can do in sigma models. It's not a thing I could do for sort of, I wouldn't have that canonical choice in general. It's a choice selected by this example. Okay. So let me just tell you now, first of all, okay, so I'm going to tell you how to get a fundamental groupoid, and I'm going to tell you how to get a whole bunch of fundamental groups, of higher homotopy groups. So let me now tell you how to get the fundamental groupoid. So here's the answer. So suppose I have a QFT, which is n plus one dimensional and has a boundary condition. So I'll start calling those open-closed TFTs. I think that this is the site of a TFT with a boundary condition is a thing that's so important that it has many, many names. In this talk, I'll call it an open-closed TFT, but you can give it any name you want. It's just a field theory with a boundary condition. I won't require my field theories to be very extended. I do need them to be at least once extended for the construction I'm doing. Framing is totally fine for me. I'm perfectly happy working with frame TFTs. So what I'll do from this is the following. So I can look at the codimension 2 disk. My bulk is n plus 1 dimensional, so that this is an n minus 1. This is a codimension 2 thing. This is the only thing I need to be once extended for, is to get this disk to be present in my TFT. And I can apply my TFT with my open-closed TFT to this disk. And if I have a TFT, whatever this is, it will be some category, just because it's the right number to be a category. And as long as my dimension is at least 3, this is a symmetric monoidal category. If my dimension is, if like n plus 1 is at least 4, so if n is at least 3. If n plus 1 is 3, then this will be a braided monoidal category. If n plus 1 is 2, this will be a monoidal category. And the reason why is because, so here's the same disk. Here's an n minus 1 disk with n minus 2 boundary. And there's a boredism from two disks to a disk called the solid pair of pants. The solid pair of pants is also called a pair of chaps, by the way, because if you take a pair of chaps, that's a solid zero-dimensional pants, is a one-dimensional chaps. So there's a sort of solid pair of pants from two disks to one disk. I've drawn it sort of both in as a boredism and from top down. So that's a multiplication map on this category. And this multiplication map is, say, braided if you're in enough dimensions, because you can continuously cross your legs. And so that continuous motion that crosses your legs is a braiding on this category. If you're in higher than our ambient dimension, if you're in 3 plus 1 or more dimensions, then you can continuously cross your legs and then sort of pass them through each other. So that makes it a symmetric monoidal category. Or at least it would make it like an E something monoidal category. I'm going to assume that I'm kind of maxing out a category number. I'm going to not do derived category theory. I'm just going to do like weak category theory that doesn't have higher than n dimensions of categoricity. So I'm symmetric monoidal. Just because, as I said, you can pass your legs through each other. So there's this really important philosophy that is called sort of the Tanakhian philosophy. And the Tanakhian philosophy says that any time you meet a symmetric monoidal category out in nature, you should pretend that it's the category of representations of a group or a groupoid. And this is sort of part of a philosophy that I think is sort of originally due to the algebraic geometers. It's the same type of thing that says that any time you are out in the world and you meet a commutative algebra, you should pretend that that commutative algebra is the functions on a space, called spec of that space. And it may or may not actually be functions on any actual space. Like, there is no space for which Z is the ring of real-valued functions on it. And there is no space for which the complex numbers is the ring of real-valued functions on it. I mean, at least the complex numbers is a nice, good, real commutative algebra. There's no space whose ring of continuous functions is the complex numbers. So instead, you just pretend the complex numbers is the ring of functions on some mystical space called spec of the complex numbers. And so that's the philosophy I'm going to take. If I have any symmetric monoidal category, I'll think of it as if it's rep G for G is some groupoid. Now, you can prove theorems that say when a category is rep G, and the answer is many of them are. And if it is rep G, you can recover G, sort of what you think of. So G is going to be sort of some sort of version of a groupoid, spec of the category, through this philosophy. The points of G are precisely what are called the fiber functors. Now, this may or may not be, like, know everything about G. Not every algebraic groupoid is affine, if you want. But this is sort of, this is how you should think about G. The elements of this groupoid are like fiber functors on your category. That's what the Tanakian philosophy says. Yes.
Even the Zaka, in some sense, like, it got Zaka,
sure. I mean, what you're saying is that state operator correspondence tells me that this category I'm thinking of is like a category of operators, because it's sort of the category assigned to a disk. And then yes, I have no objection to you thinking of this as the groupoid of vacua. I'm not going to, I mean, whatever. I'm not going to give it that name, but that's that you can give it that name. That's the, like, okay, so as I said, the points in this groupoid, I think of, they are fiber functors from C to vec. Now, there might not be any points, but if I have some, then what I can do is that, what is a fiber functor from C to vec? It's like a way of filling this disk. It's a way of coning off the disk. And that cone point may or may not come from anything in my topology. Like, it may or may not come from something, some manifold. It might really have be interpreted as an actual singular thing, as an actual defect, if you will. But that's how you could draw it. Another way you could draw it is, instead of sort of drawing this sort of as a solid red cone, I could sort of push the red part near the cone. And I could think that what this is it is choosing a Dirichlet boundary. I could think of those cone points as listing all the Dirichlet boundary conditions. And in fact, this is the right definition. So a good, or a right, maybe not the right, a right definition. So if you have a field theory and a boundary condition that you've decided to call Neumann, a good definition for what Dirichlet should mean is it should mean precisely those boundary conditions that come from this. At least these certainly do count as Dirichlet boundary conditions. That's how I want you to think about these. And so in other words, what I'm saying is that this category, it's really the category or spec of it, it's the thing that knows about all the Dirichlet boundary conditions. Okay, so now let me make sure that I'm doing it right. I always have this motivating calculation of sigma models with Neumann boundary. So if you take an actual sigma model with Neumann boundary and do the computation to figure out what this category is, you will indeed find, well, you won't quite find pi 1 of, like, this is a category. It'll be the representation, but it will literally be the representations of the fundamental groupoid when you do the calculation. So you are really getting the right answer. So implicit in this philosophy is that if you, there's a theorem that if you do have the representations of a groupoid, and if you're working over an algebraically closed field, then the points, then the spec of it is literally the groupoid. If you're not over an algebraically closed field, then it's like the G points over it. There's something about like the algebraic, the Galois group of your field or something like that. So this is the right, so that means that I'm doing it right. I'm getting the right answer, that this category is rep of my pi 1. So I feel like I've done it. I've decided, okay, so now I can give a definition. So for any open closed TFT at all, my definition is I will define the fundamental groupoid of my TFT to be this category, thought of as if it were a groupoid. And if it happens to be rep of a groupoid, then the fundamental groupoid is an actual groupoid. If it's not rep of a groupoid, then the fundamental groupoid is some sort of weird gadget from algebraic geometry. Like, maybe this category is some Dalin category GLT, which is not rep of anything, and I just decide that I just sort of shrug my shoulders and say, fine, that's some sort of algebraic groupoid scheme stack. And I just decide to work with it.
That can be empty?
Well, you know, this depended on the boundary condition. So first of all, as I said, this scheme might have no global points, or this stack might have no points. So it might just be a true, like the same way that spec C has no points over R. So this stack might have no global points, but it's still a non-trivial stack. The same way that spec C is a non-trivial stack, it's not an empty stack, but it has no points in it. And the same thing is true, and the only thing that could happen is, like, if my boundary condition, if you happen to pick the zero boundary condition and do this, then like, even, okay, I don't know, some people don't even admit zero as a valid boundary condition, but if you're the type of person who admits zero as a valid boundary condition and decided to pick it, then then you will just construct the zero category, which is the representations of the empty set. And I would tell you that fine, the fundamental group wide you reconstruct is the empty set. So what? But
yeah, there are categories that doesn't have to be defined by functors.
That's right. So and in fact, okay, that's right. So it is possible that the set of points in G is empty. But even if the set of points in G is empty, that doesn't mean that this stack is empty. It means it has no points in it.
Yes.
But in examples, this set of points is not empty. So in particular, well, the theorem that I haven't written up here is a theorem that sort of due to Deligne, which is that if Q is sufficiently compact, if I really have a good compact TFT, then this will always be, that'll imply that this category is actually symmetric fusion. And there might not be any VEC valued points in my symmetric fusion category, because it might be a fermionic category. But there will always be S VEC points in my category. So that's just the same thing, like spec C had no R points, but spec C has C points, and that those show you that it's not an empty scheme. So there is a sort of, you can always reconstruct a groupoid from a symmetric fusion category. You just put a super VEC instead of VEC here. So that there is a thing you can always do. Okay. But you know, a lot of the philosophy of quantum stuff is like you decide you're satisfied by getting a Hopf algebra instead of a group. You decide you're satisfied by getting a category instead of a groupoid, that kind of stuff. Okay, so that's the fundamental groupoid. I've done half the problem, so what's the other half? So now let me tell you the definition of the higher homotopy groups. So let me remind what I wanted to get. I wanted pi k of x was supposed to be an abelian group with an action by the fundamental groupoid. So it's a representation of the fundamental groupoid. Well, I've already told you how to get the category of all representations. Well, these are all the linear representations. And if I want to linearize an abelian group, my favorite way to linearize an abelian group is to write down the corresponding Hopf algebra of, like, say, functions on the group or the group algebra, doesn't matter. And so what I'd like to do, my goal will be to produce Hopf algebras, preferably commutative and co-commutative, inside this symmetric category. And that then I'll call myself done. If my symmetric category was indeed representations of a groupoid, and if my Hopf algebras are indeed, then my Hopf algebras have a good chance. Then those Hopf algebras will just be equivariant Hopf algebras for the groupoid, and they have a very good chance of being abelian groups, sort of honest abelian groups. And otherwise, they're just an algebraic version. They're like algebraic groups rather than actual groups. Okay, so now I'll tell you, so let me tell you how to do this. So in particular, I'm after Hopf algebra objects in my category. So in particular, I'm after objects in my category. And my category was the codimension 2 disk. And so if I have any codimension 1 manifold that fills the codimension 2 disk, that'll give me an object. And these are everything has a Lyapunov boundary. So if I have a codimension 2 solid, codimension 1 solid manifold filling this disk. So another way of saying, what is it to say I have a manifold filling a disk? Another way of talking about a manifold filling a disk is to say you just take a manifold, take a solid manifold, and just like take a bite out of it. And that'll be sort of the disk boundary. So yeah, really, like, I think we were very hungry when we sort of did this part of the project. So I really want you to think that what this is like a jelly donut. And it has some sort of like the boundary is, the glazing on the outside of the donut. And then there's some jelly in the middle. And you take a bite. And then you can sort of see in and maybe some jelly oozes out. But that's like what's really going on here. So I'm going to start talking to sort of like manifolds with bites taken out of them. OK, and so now our theorem is the following. Our theorem is, and this is the sort of same thing I told you two slides ago. The theorem is, if I take a sphere times a disk and take a bite out of it, then that object in this category is naturally a Hopf algebra. And I sort of already told you this. I told you the multiplication map is the sphere times the solid pants, the chaps. And and then you take a bite out of the whole thing. And the co-multiplication is the pants times the solid disk. And then you take a bite out to get into the bite category. So here's a picture of the two-dimensional chaps. So there's these are the multiplication and co-multiplication, I haven't proven this to you yet, but I will, I'll sort of tell you why we know this to be, that this is a Hopf algebra. But here's the formulas for multiplication and co-multiplication. I can also tell you a formula for the antipode. The formula for the antipode is a sort of CPT type theorem. So this was a sphere times a disk. So something I'm allowed to do is pick one of the k directions of the sphere and reflect it. And I can take one of the k directions of the disk and reflect it. So I don't know which one's time and which one's space, but one of these is a spatial reflection and the other is a temporal reflection, if you will. So that's like overall two reflections. That's orientation preserving. I'm working with framed TFTs, but it turns out that if you do this operation to the sphere times disk, you can untwist the framings and get an actual involution on this. Well, not an involution. You can get an actual map. So you pick up some extra stuff when you do the untwistings, but you can get an actual self map from this framed manifold to itself. And that turns out to be the antipode. I'm just telling you that answer. We did that. We sort of worked it out. This wasn't how we invented it. We just like sat down and started writing formulas and noticed that this was the antipode. So, So that's the sort of first punchline as we have these. So now I want to tell you why all these are true. How much time do I have?
About half now.
Oh, perfect. Okay, good. So, there's the first. This is like the first takeaway: is every TFT with a boundary condition does have homotopy groups. Well, if you're in very low dimension, then your category is only braided and not commutative. It still makes sense to talk about Hopf algebras in a braided category, but it does not make sense to talk about commutative Hopf algebras in a braided category. Not really. And so if you're in very low dimension, this is like a more quantum version. But in high dimension, these are just a symmetric Mendel category and commutative Hopf algebras, which are as good as groups can get. So let me tell you how to actually do this. Now I'll actually tell you why we get a Hopf algebra. So I'm going to tell you what seems like a slightly different construction, because it's a very powerful construction that is a really good way to produce Hopf algebras. In fact, this is the only way I know to produce a Hopf algebra. I think every Hopf algebra I know comes from this construction. So now I'll prove that we get a Hopf algebra. So I'm allowed, this was the formulas here were just formulas that took place in the Bordism category. So I'm allowed to prove them just by working in the Bordism category. I'm only applying them to the top dimensions, but in the process of the proof, it's just something about the top dimensions of the Bordism category. I'm allowed to reach deeper into the Bordism category to do the calculation, as long as at the end I'm just proving something about the top dimensions, because the top dimensions embed fully faithfully into the whole category. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to just do a calculation in the Bordism category. So where in the Bordism category? OK, I'll get back to that in a moment. Let me sort of change topics. So there's the theorem I told you is an immediate. So a rollery is a thing that immediately implies a theorem. So here's the rollery. This is, by the way, this is sort of, I think, first worked out by David Reuter. He gave a talk, kind of the first time he and I met was 7 years ago here, I think, in this room. And he spoke about sort of these pictures. So I think it was in this room. So here's what you do. So suppose you have any infinity 3 category at all. Maybe the Bordism category, maybe something else, I don't care. Suppose you have any infinity 3 category. And for convenience, I'm going to ask it to have all adjoints. We can do a more general statement, but that'll be good enough for today. So I have an infinity 3 category with all adjoints. A retract is just the following. A retract is two objects. This is a retract of y onto x. A retract, the definition of a retract is it's two objects, a downward morphism, an upward morphism, and an isomorphism so that if you go up and back down, that's just the identity on x. And I don't ask anything else about going down and back up. So this is like half of an isomorphism between x and y. It's a retract of x onto y. So that's the input to my construction. And I claim that in any 3 category with all adjoints and any retract, I can get a Hopf algebra. And where does the Hopf algebra live? Well, I'm in a 3 category. So the endomorphisms of x is a 2 category with a composition loss. It's a monoidal 2 category. If I take the identity objects there, so if I take the 2-dimensional endomorphisms of x, this is a 1 category with 2 multiplications, one from each of the dimensions that I've sort of endoed for. So it's a braided monoidal 1 category. So the theorem is that we always get Hopf algebras in the braided monodal infinity one categories of endomorphisms of whatever object I'm standing at. And our proof, I won't tell you the proof. It's a pure category proof. It's just a sort of, there's no topology, sort of no manifolds get sort of are hurt in the construction in the proof. So I won't tell you the proof, although I'm happy to tell it to you somewhat like later. But it doesn't make as good pictures. So the pictures are the following. So if you unpack our proof in pictures, what you get is the following. Here's the formula for the Hopf algebra. What you do is, so here's ambient object X. I need to give you a two morphism from X to itself. So here's my morphism. So it's this picture. I have a square with two boundaries given by my morphism G, two boundaries given by my morphism F, and I have to put some adjoints in to make them go the right direction. So G is a map from X to Y, F is a map from Y back to X. So I guess for me, time goes from east to west and from bottom to top. So here's some composition. And then you have to, where the boundary conditions meet, you put versions of this isomorphism or its inverses. And then if you think carefully, you realize, and these are like mates of the isomorphisms. And so this is an iso. These are just mates of isos. They're not necessarily isos themselves. And this is now what happens is if you go all the way around the square, each time you go around the square, you pick up a little bit of extra angle. And when you walk all the way around the square, you pick up an extra, you get off by about a 720 degrees worth of angle. And so you have to untwist that. And so there's a little bit of framing stuff. If you don't care about framing stuff, then you don't care about this. But we cared about framing stuff. There's a little bit of untwisting I have to do at the top. But that's the formula, yes?
Is that rad?
Yeah, rad. Rad stands for Radford. That's right. So it's like what I put there is I put the morphism phi, I put like the twice mate of phi, and I put the compatibility of that with the Radford on either side. So really what it is like you squeeze a Radford in sort of anywhere you want, but Radford's natural. Mm-hmm. So it's just like any Radford and phi.
Yeah, makes perfect sense.
Okay. And so this is up to framing issues. You can ignore all of like that stuff. And up to framing issues, this is just a square with two boundaries, sort of walking around the two sides. And here's a picture of the multiplication. The multiplication is you put two square. I need a map from two squares to one square. And the multiplication is you do the sort of orange pants. And green just goes along for the right. And if the co-multiplication is I need a map from one square to two squares, and I do a green pants. And orange goes along for the right. So this is, it turns out this always gives you a Hopf algebra. And I have two interpretations of it. So it's actually really a useful strategy in general. So what you could have, as an example, you could imagine, so here's a different example that's not the one I'm doing. A different example is when X is the vacuum theory for whatever in your sort of, you have like X is some vacuum. And Y is some actual topological field, or some actual quantum field theory, maybe topological. And F is perhaps Neumann for your quantum field theory, and G is Dirichlet for your quantum field theory, for some versions of that. Or anyway, these are two boundary conditions. For them to be, for the composition, for it to be a retract, for the composition to be isomorphic to the identity and not just have a map to it. So having a map to it is just like having some corner. For it to actually be a retract, to have that corner be invertible, is precisely that these two boundary conditions intersect transversely. So what I'm telling you is I'm telling you that any time you have a TFT with two boundary conditions which intersect transversely, you always get a Hopf algebra. And this is, yes?
Can one kind of have some geometric intuition for the relation that relates multiplication and co-multiplication in this?
So.
This is different for Hopf algebra and the Frobenius algebra. Everyone
that's
is
right.
used to Frobenius algebra, and can one somehow see why the Hopf algebra?
Right. So notice that one of them is orange and the other one's green.
Yeah.
So I even have some orange and green here. So the point is that if you, I drew them as the squares were next to each other, but there was a little bit, they had to skew a little bit. Mm-hmm. So what's really going on is that I really should have started with two squares kind of like that, where sort of they're at an angle. And then I multiply. See, a braided monodal category gives me lots of directions. So I'm allowed to put them at an angle like this. And then when I multiply, OK, let me not draw that. Let me just draw them as, yeah, well, whatever. I put them as squares. And then when I multiply, I can multiply them to one thing. And now it's just sort of, they just fuse sort of in the northeast to southwest direction. So it's sort of two maps fusing like that. And when they co-multiply, well, they co-multiply in the other direction, if I want them to. So, and so that this is nice and valid, because if I co-multiplied first, I'd co-multiply them to sort of the other direction. And now when I multiply them, now you see what the in a braided category what the rule should be. And if you draw this type of picture, if you draw everything slightly askew, you will be just naturally led to the right axioms. So now you could ask, OK, what's going on? Why is this a Hopf algebra? So these are supposed to be equal. And this sort of doesn't look right, because this has genus 0 and this has genus 1. And what's going on is when you trace through it, you see some sort of, there's some single purple circle that interpolates in the middle there. And then that's where you have to use that this is really a retract and not just a generic boundary. So that's where you use the transversality, is to pull that circle to a closed. And that's the proof. It's like transversality means that this circle can contract away.
So could one summarize that you have basically two directions which are important? And
yes.
When you kind of take into account how they can fuse, because you keep track, you cannot just do the Frobenius algebra fusing that would kind of destroy everything, but you need an additional datum in the middle, this purple thing that then allows you to do the Hopf algebra.
That's right. And it really is important that one of my multiplications is orange and the other one's green.
Phil?
Yes.
So one of your examples was I have my square is some kind of topological order in 2D,
yeah,
two different kinds of boundary conditions. And then, so if you do that, what is the Hopf algebra you get as? Is it like related to
QFT? So, well, I will just tell you the answer. I mean, you should just go and do it. Which 2D topological orders have two boundary conditions that meet transversely? And the answer is they are precisely the doubles of Hopf algebras. And you get the Hopf algebra back. And that's a good exercise. I should also make an acknowledgement that Tudor de Mofta, I think, is pretty soon going to have a paper out that does this stuff with less compactness and gets a lot of like the quantum groups from Trans-Siemens theory out of this construction. That's my understanding. I mean, this is like, I'm like on camera. I shouldn't promise things that I haven't done. But there's a lot of stuff that's like not me that sort of is using this type of methods. And anyway, I'm kind of fairly compact, fairly finite. But you can push this in lots of directions. But yeah, in the sort of Levin-Wen case, the only time a Levin-Wen model can have a transverse boundary condition, so you take the Levin-Wen model, you take its Levin-Wen boundary, and you ask, when does that admit a transverse boundary condition? And that's a fun exercise to do. And you find out that transverse boundary conditions are exactly the same as fiber functors. And so they exactly write your fusion category as rep of a Hopf algebra. And I think that statement, up to translating the words, I think, is already in the sort of tensor categories book. So, but it's a good exercise. You know, the next time you teach a fusion category class, make them do it. So,
which I do all the time.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, you might. Like. Okay, so this is what we do. So that's how we get the Hopf algebras. So now let me tell you a little bit more. Let me talk about Frobenius algebras. So I was telling you something about I had a green multiplication and an orange co-multiplication. And it looks very much, if I just draw these pictures and don't think about framings, it does sure look like actually the orange multiplication is part of an orange Frobenius structure. And it looks very much like the green multiplication is part of a green Frobenius structure. And these statements are almost correct. But they're not quite correct. So let me tell you what is actually correct. So those would be true if I was doing oriented field theory, by the way. But I'm doing framed field theory, and that's why they're only almost correct. So let me tell you a bit about Frobenius algebras and tell you sort of why you never have to check whether an antipode exists. So here's a nice fact. If you have a bialgebra, what's a bialgebra? That has a multiplication and a coalgebra structure, and there's this bialgebra relation here. And suppose that it has the property. It's called Frobenius Hopf. If you can equip it with an integral, so an integral is a sort of wrong way map for in orange, And a co-integral is a wrong way map in green, and the relations, the equations they have to satisfy is that if you integrate and multiply, if you sort of do an orange integral and a green multiplication, then that snips it out to pure orange. And on the other hand, a green hits an orange to get two pure greens. Those are the equations to be, that's the definition of integral and co-integral. And if you have these, and suppose that it has the, so then you could write down this composition. And suppose that this composition suppose this composition accidentally happens to be an anti-automorphism of your algebra and co-algebra structures. Then it's a nice exercise to show that this morphism is an antipode for your Hopf algebra, and that you've actually shown that your pi algebra is Hopf. And any finite dimensional Hopf algebra, sort of, this is the reason why finite dimensional Hopf algebras tend to be Hopf, is they really tend to be sort of Hopf Frobenius. And you can also show that then this, like, well, that automatically forces the green trace pairing to be invertible because it has an inverse given by the orange up to this sort of invertible antipode. And so you really get a Hopf Frobenius algebra. There's a slight weakening of this. This required an extra choice of data. See, I could have rescaled this guy by a factor of 2 and this guy by a factor of 1/2, and I won't change this thing. And so I'd like to undo that extra scaling dimension. So there's a sort of slight generalization of it where instead of just an actual map from nothing to my Hopf algebra, an actual element of my Hopf algebra, I could have a map from some invertible object that might not be the ground, the trivial object. So I'll just put a dashed line for that invertible object. And this is called a twisted Frobenius algebra, is when it's sort of Frobenius except has an extra invertible object floating around. And then the equation is that you sort of have like a twisted, a sort of, they both should be twisted by the same amount, and then you trace it out. So here's the theorem. So these are just facts. These are facts you can find in the 1990s. We spent some time looking for them. So the first fact is, as I said, if this composition is an anti-automorphism, then it's the specific anti-automorphism called the antipode. It's a nice exercise. These are all, like you can do these as exercises if you like playing with string diagrams for Hopf algebras. The first exercise, by you can do these, I mean I like, Harshit Yadav can do these. That's what I mean, because he's the one who told us all of this stuff. So this happens to be the antipode. And then the second fact is that this is the universal situation. So this theorem is, this isn't due to me, this is, as I said, from the 90s or something, is that if you have a braided monoidal category, and if your Hopf algebra is dualizable, so if you're, say, a rigid braided monoidal category, and you have a Hopf algebra, then your Hopf algebra is automatically twisted Frobenius Hopf, at least if you can split an antipode. So what you can do is you can write down a universal formula for the universal integral and co-integral, which just has some, like, you have to split an idempotent somewhere. So it has to be a Karubi complete category to do this. So this is universal. Every single finite dimensional Hopf algebra is always of this type in any braided fusion category, in any braided monoidal category at all. Not necessarily a fusion. All I use is rigidity. So this is completely universal. In our example, the invertible thing is not the ground field, but it's almost the ground fields, almost the sort of the vacuum. So it's the bigon where I put the inverse to my retract data, and then I don't quite put the retract. I put it twisted by 720 degrees. If I didn't have this Radford here, this would just be the phi composed with its inverse, and this would just be the trivial object. So if I'm sort of sufficiently oriented that I don't have to keep track of rotations, then this is just trivial, and otherwise this is what it is. And so this is why we get Hopf algebras. I didn't even have to check if there's an antipode. I just check that there is an integral and co-integral. So I told you about this because I want to tell you another definition that we had to figure out, which was the following. So where am I going to? So I told you how to get homotopy groups out of these, quote, quantum spaces. And homotopy groups aren't very good unless you have good ways to compute them. And in homotopy theory, your favorite thing to do with homotopy groups is to assemble them into long exact sequences. And so that's where I'm going for. That's my next goal, is to tell you how to assemble homotopy groups into long exact sequences. OK, so I have to tell you a little bit more. So another nice notion that some of you may have come across, but probably most of you haven't, is the following. If you have a square of, in a, say, at least a 2 category, say a square of functors or a square of morphisms in a 2 category, And if the morphisms have adjoints, then you can take half the adjoints. You could say take just the adjoints of the vertical arrows. And you can look at another square that has just the vertical, where I've reversed the direction of vertical arrows. And if this is a commuting square, it might not happen that this commutes. It might not. It'll always be like fillable by something, by a two-morphism, but that two-morphism will typically not be invertible. And an interesting thing that sometimes happens and sometimes doesn't is that this square happens to commute. It might happen, it might not. And you can just do examples. And it's an interesting feature, an interesting phenomenon of a problem when it happens to commute. And it's a sufficiently important, interesting feature that it has a name. It's called Beck-Chevalier condition. I don't know why Beck and Chevalier cared about it, but that's what it's called. So this is just the definition. A square is called Beck-Chevalier when this like half adjoint square also commutes. The vertical adjoint square also commutes. Okay. So that's something you can do with respect to the categorical adjoint, when you have like adjoint morphisms in a higher category. Here's another thing you can do, which is different. So what we care about eventually is I'm going to care about like putting Hopf algebras or groups or something like that, Hopf algebras, and morphisms between groups, morphisms between Hopf algebras. Those definitely don't have adjoints in the sense of category theory, because it's just a one category. There's no categorical adjoint to a map of vector spaces. But there's other types of adjoints out there in the world. Like adjoint functor is not the first type of adjoint. The first type of adjoint is the linear adjoint to a linear map between inner product spaces, or the Hermitian adjoint to a bounded map between Hilbert spaces. Those were the adjoints that started the game. So if you have a square, so I'll just repeat the definition, but I'll do it just in Hilbert spaces or inner product spaces. If I have a square of inner product spaces, then another thing I could do is just take the linear adjoints to those morphisms. And I could ask, does that square still commute? And usually the answer is no. But it might happen to accidentally commute. That's what I really care about, is sort of this linear adjoint. Well, I have to be a little bit more careful, because the case I care about isn't quite. See, if I had a Frobenius algebra, then the sort of green trace pairing would really be a good inner product, and I would have a well-defined adjoint map. I don't really have a good Frobenius algebra. I have something twisted by an invertible. And so this inner product isn't really an inner product. It's like an inner product up to an invertible factor that I can't control. And so the adjoint map isn't really a map in the wrong direction. It's a map up to some invertible objects, up to some scaling factors that I haven't kept track of. That's all a sort of ambiguous invertible is. It's just like meaning I haven't tracked a scaling factor. It's like working projectively. So the actual definition we need is the following. If I have a square, say between, if these are all Hopf algebras, and in fact they're all, say, Frobenius Hopf, or these sort of twisted Frobenius Hopf algebras, then what I can do is I can try to take the sort of wrong direction square, and I pick up some factors of invertibles. See, when I write down the adjoint to a map, what is the adjoint, the linear adjoint to a map? The linear adjoint to a map is you put the map, and then you put some pairings and co-pairings on it. But these are off by some invertibles, and these invertibles are different. I can't cancel them off. See, before, like here, I could cancel off the invertibles because they were the same invertible. But in this case, I just have no way to cancel them off. One of them's an invertible that has to do with the Hopf algebra B. The other one's an entirely unrelated invertible object. They just don't cancel. So if I try to write down the sort of other square I get off by some invertibles. One side around, I get that product of invertibles. And the other side around, I get a different product of invertibles. So I'm going to call my square Beck-Chevalier, sort of Hopf Beck-Chevalier, twisted Frobenius Hopf Beck-Chevalier. I need a shorter name than that. If I happen to have an isomorphism between these two invertibles, such that this sort of wrong way square commutes. This sounds terrible because it sounds like it depends on the choice of isomorphism. It actually usually this isomorphism, if it exists, it's unique. And a sufficient condition for it to exist to be unique is the following. Any Hopf algebra has an antipode. You can take the square of the antipode. You can take the trace of the square of the antipode. That's an endomorphism of the unit object in your category. That endomorphism may or may not be invertible. If it happens to be invertible, then I call my Hopf algebra regular. That implies, like, regularity is strong enough to make this a property. This isomorphism either doesn't exist Like either this square just cannot be made to commute, or it can be made to commute in a unique way. In the case of vector spaces, regularity is the same as the Hopf algebra being semi-simple and co-semi-simple. So that's a good, this is like a kind of version of semi-simplicity that never references vector spaces, never references linear structure. Okay, so now that I've given you that definition, I think this is, no, this is my second to last slide. And I don't know what time I have. I have five, perfect, okay. So our theorem is the following. So this is a nice example. So why did I tell you about, this sort of seemed out of nowhere when I told you about Beck-Chevalier. Okay, Beck-Chevalier squares are interesting, you should go learn about them, but why did I tell you about them? The reason I told you about them is the following. If you have a sequence, a short exact sequence of finite abelian groups, suppose you have a short exact sequence of finite groups, not necessarily abelian, finite groups. Well, a short exact sequence of finite groups, exactness, well, sorry, a short sequence of finite groups. A sequence means that if you do A to B and then B to C, you get the zero map, the trivial map. If you have a sequence of finite groups, you can take the corresponding, say, sequence of group algebras. And that's a sequence of Hopf algebras, and it's a sequence in the sense that the composition is the same, not, it's no longer the zero map, but it's the linearization of zero. It's the map through the ground fields. And you can ask, is this square Beck-Chevalier? And the answer is, well, if your sequence is exact, then this square is Beck-Chevalier. And the converse is almost true. If the square is Beck-Chevalier, and if you have some regularity condition, like if the regularity is strong enough, all you need is to say the kernel of this map is non-zero over your field, so regularity is more than strong enough for that, if these are regular Hopf algebras, then this Beck-Chevalier condition is exactly the same, for this square, is exactly the same as asking this sequence to be exact. And so this is a version of exactness that you can do equationally. And this was something we worked really hard on for a long time, because exactness sounds like the definition of an exact sequence has all these like limits and colimits in it. You take like the kernel of a thing and the image of a thing, which is a type of colimit. And so functors famously do not preserve exactness. This is why you do derived categories. But TFTs are just functorial. There's no way a TFT could produce exactness without some reason, some equational version of exactness. And so this is an equational version of exactness. That's weaker than exactness, but equivalent to exactness in the regular case. So that's what I'll do. If I have a sequence of Hopf algebras, so what is a sequence? That means that any sort of a long sequence, being a sequence means that any composition should be trivial. So in other words, if I go A to B and B to C, that should factor through the ground, through the whatever unit object you have in your category. I'll call my sequence, say, twisted Frobenius Hopf exact, I don't know, Hopf exact. If these sequences are all Beck-Chevalier, if these squares are all Beck-Chevalier. And as I said, this is a good definition if you know you're regular. It's a sort of mediocre definition if your Hopf algebras are not regular. And so an example is that a nice exercise is that if you take the trivial map of Hopf algebra, so the constant map, the map that goes down to the ground field and back up, and if you ask, is this sequence of Hopf algebras, Hopf exact. Well, again, if you, for instance, know that A and C are regular, then that's and that the sequence is Hopf exact, then you can prove that the middle term is trivial. So it's a good way to detect triviality of sort of in long exact sequences. So yeah, it's not a very good definition in the irregular case. I just don't think there is one. So I have 1 minute, 2 minutes. I have loads of time. This is my last slide. So the reason I wanted to tell you about this was the Pupa sequence. So in homotopy theory, so now let me go back to classical homotopy theory. In homotopy theory, if you have a fiber bundle, well, if you have a fiber bundle, what you can do is you can write down the homotopy groups of all the points in the fiber bundle. And as I said, I'm doing this sort of the right way. I'm doing this sort of in families over the base point. The right place to have a base point is actually Y. So any base point in Y does map to a base point in X. The homotopy groups of Y are already parameterized by Y. The homotopy groups of X are parameterized by pi 1 of X, but that receives a map from Y, because any base point in Y does map to a base point in X. And then it's a neat feature that actually the homotopy groups of the fiber look like they're parameterized by the base points in the fiber, but they're actually parameterized by the base points in Y. They're actually sort of acted on by the base points in Y. And so the long exact sequence in homotopy groups is actually a long exact sequence of pi 1 of y in the category of pi 1 of y equivariant things. So this is the type of thing that I can do with my constructions. So what do I want to do quantumly? So I need a quantum version of a fiber bundle. Well, the fiber is no data. The fiber is just extracted from y to x. So I just need a quantum version of a map. And a quantum version of a map is a boundary condition. Well, my space, I encoded my space as a bulk with its Neumann boundary. I'll encode the map into the space as some other boundary, some mixed Neumann-Dirichlet, and then the sort of the Neumann boundary for the mixed Neumann-Dirichlet boundary condition. And so that's how I'll think about, that's going to be my quantum version of a bundle. And I won't tell it to you because I'm out of time. So this is what it was. This is an a relative open-closed TFT. See, I said that like this idea of sort of a thing with a boundary condition has lots of names. Open-closed is one of them. Relative is another one. I'm just going to use both of them. And our main theorem is that any time you input a relative open-closed TFT to me, if you just give me a TFT, I told you a sequence of homotopy groups, a list of homotopy groups. If you give me an relative open-closed TFT, I can give you a sort of long exact sequence, one of these kind of Hopf-Long exact sequences. And the example, Lucas wants me to stop, is that here's an interesting thing that does not come from spaces. An interesting example that very much does not come from spaces is when my sort of x is the empty, is the vacuum with some boundary condition, which I'm now going to call bulk. But it was like a boundary for the empty. And my y is also the vacuum theory with some boundary condition, which is now just really just a boundary condition for the bulk. And if I run, I didn't tell you the formulas, I'll just tell you the answer. If you compute the long exact sequence that we get for this example, what we end up computing is the Hopf algebras we get measure observables in the bulk, observables in the boundary, observables in the bulk that can touch the boundary, all up to condensation. And the differentials in the long exact sequence end up measuring linkings of observables, Hopf linkings. And the exactness has like physical meaning that every observable should be detectable by linking from another observable. And as an example, what we find is that the boundary observable linkings, the linkings of pure boundary operators, that being non-degenerate, so those differentials being invertible, is exactly the same as the bulk being invertible. So there's an application of this stuff. So thank you for your attention.
Any other questions? No, let me start. The homotopy groups that you represent by taking some spheres of solid things.
Yeah.
So these usually can be interpreted as operators, like extended operators in the series.
Yes, that's right.
So what type of operators are what type of homotopy groups? So, if I look at my case, is k-dimensional operators living on?
So this is, these are the, so these you should think of as the, see if I can get it right. So these are the operators that live along the core of the solid torus. So they're so pi k is I think the k dimension. Now I'm going to get this wrong. With 50% chance this is correct. yes. So in general you're getting like the. You're measuring things about the operators on the boundary, and you're either measuring the operators or so. If I have a Hopf algebra, it's like, do you want me to think of that as a group algebra, or do you want me to think of that as the algebra functions on a group? And those are two ways you can think about a commutative and co-commutative Hopf algebra. And so what I'm getting is I'm getting a Hopf algebra, and you're asking me, it's one of those. It's either the functions. It's either the sort of group algebra of the operators, of the group of operators, or it's the functions on the group of operators. But it's always the boundary operators. No, sorry, operators confined to the boundary.
Ah, I see. So are the bulk operators somewhere?
If I do this sort of long exact sequence, than other entries in the long exec sequence produce. So what I did here, so that's what if I just like had a bulk and a boundary kind of put it horizontally. If I, another thing I can do with a bulk boundary is make this square. And then I get more homotopy groups out of it. So for instance, if I had a bulk and a boundary, I told you the boundary operators. If you want just the pure bulk operators, just forget about the boundary. Think about the bulk as if it's relative to the vacuum. Do the same construction. Those are the pure bulk operators. So those are two of the entries in my long exec sequence. One of them is the pure boundary operators. One of them is the bulk boundary operators. Those are the pure bulk operators. The third one I didn't tell you how to get, but it's the sort of bulk operators that can end at the boundary. And I should say, like this construction, it's very explicitly not symmetric under changing the two directions. Like it does one thing to this picture, and if you reflect this picture, you get a different long exec sequence. No, like if you, for instance, if you take this picture where some of them are vacua, in the way I drew it, you get a really interesting sequence that knows all about S matrix linkings. And if you reflect it and then apply our construction that I didn't tell you, you get a sort of totally stupid sequence. You get like the sequence that's just like the kth homotopy group itself trivial. The kth plus oneth homotopy group itself trivial. And it's just like the stupid sequence. So.
I'm not quite sure about how the role of phi here. So I'm asking if I change the TFT to be I oriented TFT.
Yeah.
Then do you get just the group? The half algebra you get from the construction is just a group.
So if you change to an oriented TFT, the one major thing that changes is you don't have to worry about these invertibles here. That these invertibles trivialize. And the orientation structure chooses a trivialization of these invertibles. You still do have to worry about the invertibles in the following sense. If you want to do this sort of, so that for any specific hypergroup, for any specific Hopf algebra, you don't have to worry about it. But the trivializations you get aren't compatible. So you will get a trivialization of this guy, you will get a trivialization of this guy. Those trivializations the trivialization of here and the trivialization of this are not the trivialization that together you want to use for exactness. You need to pick something else. So it's still better not to trivialize these invertibles, to just work with the framed theories. Because this actually confused us for a really long time. We kept writing down things that were like off by a scalar. We could explicitly compute it. We were like, why the hell are all of these things off by a scalar? And then we realized that if we just worked fully framed, then our scalar was not a scalar. It was an element of a non-trivial invertible object. And so we had to be off by it. And that's what that was sort of very clarifying for us. Other than that, I don't think anything happens. And I should say, I want to emphasize, these are Hopf algebras in the category that I assigned to a disk. So to get a Hopf algebra in vector spaces, you have to do something else. You have to apply a fiber functor to that category. And you may or may not have fiber functors on that category.
Can you repeat your construction to like oriented TFT, spin TFT, all this?
Yeah. It applied to any framed TFT. So any oriented TFT, forget the fact that an oriented TFT is better than a framed TFT. An oriented TFT is something that you can be put on a manifold that only has an orientation. Whereas a framed TFT is something that a priori can only be put on manifolds. See, so this is actually a problem with the language we use. We say oriented and framed, and it sounds like being framed is more data. On a manifold, a framing is a lot of data. And for TFTs, TFTs are like dual to manifolds. So we should really use dual language. We should have called it co-oriented, and we could have called it co-framed. And so a co-oriented TFT is something that pairs with oriented manifolds, and a co-framed TFT is something that pairs with framed manifolds. And so a co-orientation is lots of data, because it has to make up for the fact that an oriented manifold is not very much data. Whereas a co-framed TFT is very little data comparatively, because it makes up for the fact that the manifolds it places on have a lot of data.
So in dimension three, in one of the points that you kind of listed, list of facts, can I think of these, this invertible object I as the rhythm twist element in the Hopf algebra? Maybe they're related?
I don't remember. So these are, I mean, as I said, these are facts that are not, okay, this last fact is one that we computed, but these first two facts are just classical. They're sort of things that experts in Hopf algebras knew 20 years ago.
So if I take the signal model into a KGN, that's also an Eilenberg-McLane space in a sense. If I twist that by a cocycle, is that still an Eilenberg-McLane TFT, or is that something with
this
more
homotopic groups? This is a great question. I have not done very many computations in the twisted case. So if you turn on a non-trivial Diaghoff-Witten action, you have broken the Neumann boundary condition. It's no longer available.
That's right.
I mean, that's like the existence of Neumann boundary is the trivialization of the Diaghoff-Witten action. And so so I don't know. My formula requires that you select a boundary condition. And of course, like, you might have other ones. You might have a Dirichlet still available for you. And I just haven't, like, I could probably go and do the computation. I don't remember the answer off the top of my head. But, you know, whether you think a sigma model is, what degree you think it is, depends on which boundary condition. Because even without Diaghoff-Witten actions, you know that there are dualities. There's electromagnetic dualities that change KGNs for KGP minus Ns or something like that. So.
Okay, so let's send 0 again. Okay.